Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So I thought I would kick off this week by talking a little bit about the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine that was rewarded to three people. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the seed of all of this. But first, we have to go get in the Wayback Machine and go back to what, among other things, I and most doctors of my vintage were taught in medical school, which was that when we were born with a very, very large gland in our chest called the thymus. In fact, one of the spoofing things that she used to do to a third year medical student was show them a picture of a newborn baby and say, well, what's your diagnosis, doctor? And of course, you would be fooled and you would say pneumonia, because the thymus creates a white shadow on the surface of the lungs and it looks like a double pneumonia until you look more carefully and see the smooth contours of the gland. But you know, initiation hazing aside, we were taught that the thymus is so big in childhood because its job is to eliminate any T cells that would attack self. So it basically just has a whole list of self antigens, and it just compares any the T cells are created. And essentially the way that they're created so that they can go after any possible combination of proteins, almost any possible. And then they are created with all these possibilities. Then they're tested against the self, and the ones that are able to attack self are zapped. And that was what we were taught with was going on, that it was a central mechanism of the thymus, and that the mechanism wasn't perfect. And so some autoreactive T cells escaped into the peripheral circulation. And by the time you get to 1 year old, your thymus is like a tenth of the original size. And we all have a thymus there, kind of withered little prune-like thing in our neck, but you can't even barely find it. And unless it gets cancer, and then you have a thymoma, and those are rare, and we aren't covering that. But a scientist in the mid-80s started working at the Achilles Cancer Research, and he was doing basic science, and he was interested in how if you take the thymus out early in mice, that they would develop severe autoimmune disease. If you did the thymectomy 3 days after birth, and this suggested that there might be some protective cells that were also in the thymus, and by removing them, you prevented those from protecting the little mice against the autoimmune diseases. So he said there's probably some kind of security guard, specialized cells that actively suppress potentially harmful immune responses. And this was revolutionary because it questioned the orthodoxy that immune tolerance was not simply a passive elimination process of the thymus, but actually an active regulatory mechanism that operated throughout life. So it took him 10 years of painstaking research, but he discovered that a certain type of CD4 cells, and anyone old enough to remember AIDS might remember CD4 and CD8 T cells, and AIDS goes after the CD4 cells, so the ratio changes, and that was before we had a blood test. That was one of our markers. Having a high CD8 to CD4 was suggestive that you might have something winnowing away or infecting your CD4 cells. So that was used as an early, what we call a surrogate marker for HIV before the blood tests came online. About 5 years, no, more like 7 years into the disease. So we had a little window there where we were chewing our nails and really couldn't tell if anybody had HIV. So he discovered that certain CD4 cells had an extra receptor, the CD25 molecule. And it turns out the CD25 molecule is like half of the interleukin-2 receptor being repurposed as a tissue surface marker. That's interesting in and of itself. But I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, the best way to talk about surface markers is to put it in flag semaphore. So back in the ancient days before radios, ships would at sea would communicate with each other by these colorful flags that were easy to spot from a distance, and they formed a kind of conceptual alphabet. I mean, you could run up the pirate flag, right? But there were a whole bunch of other more useful flags that indicated, you know, we're out of water, or we need personnel, or we have disease on board, please, you know, stay away from us, or that we need assistance, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was an active language. It was used in wartime as well, you know, code breaking and all of that. But after 10 years, Dr. Sakaguchi published his landmark paper where he identified these CD4 and CD25 two flag cells, basically, and showed that they possessed potent immunosuppressive capabilities. These cells, among other things, could prevent the development of the autoimmune disease when you transferred them into those thymectomized mice that he'd been using. And they were only 2% of all the CD4 cells out there, and they had a very unique role, which was to turn down the inflammatory response. And they were infectious. They could infect or convert other T cells into their type and turn a recruit, if you will, other cells to become regulatory T cells. And so that's all well and good, but science, we spread the information around. So meanwhile, in the early 2000s, Mary Brunko and Fred Ramsdell collected molecular detective work. They were looking at something called scurfy mice, and scurfy mice are animals with a hereditary X-linked autoimmune syndrome. So X-linked hereditary diseases, by definition, are going to affect males more seriously than females, because you only need one X chromosome with a bad mutation on it to get sick. Females, on the other hand, because they have two X chromosomes, have a much better chance of not getting the bad X chromosome. And there's a form of, I'm going to use cognitive disorder related to intelligence. I'm not sure what the term du jour is for this, but basically a form of developmental delay that is X-linked. And there are a number of X-linked diseases, probably a whole bunch of them. When they looked at these mice, and it's 2003, so we have the early technology to read the genetic map, and they looked at 170 million base pairs, and they found mutations consistently in a previously unknown gene that they named FOXP3. And this gene encodes a transcription factor. And that a transcription factor is essentially a gene that controls other genes. So when you make the product of this gene, what you get is a key that can turn on gene suites of other genes. And so it's a way of it's a control system. It's a way of allowing for signals to down-regulate the transcription factor. So you can block that with a methylation group, for example, in epigenetics. And then it will not get transcribed, so you will not fire off the other gene suite. It's very, very important during embryologic development. So this turned out to be a master regulator of regulatory T cell development. And so the two of them got together effectively and collaborated, and Sakaguchi's team demonstrated that the FOXP3 controls the development and function of the regulatory cells. So this established the molecular foundation and explained the mechanisms, extremely, extremely key. And I've already explained how the FOXP3 sits on the gene, but it can activate the T-reg specific cells and suppress the effector C cells program. So it can, in other words, it can turn on some genes and turn off others. And then comes the human connection. So the scurfy mice led directly to, okay, we've got this FOXP3. Let's see if this happens in humans. And indeed it does. It's called IPEX. Looks completely different than it looks in the mice. But what you get is type 1 diabetes, severe diarrhea and failure to thrive, autoimmune skin rashes like eczema, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, so the immune cells attack the red blood cells, and autoimmune low platelets. And the disease is fatal without treatment before the age of 3. So this is a very severe genetic disease. And so now we have the connection, T regulatory function and autoimmune disease. Let's go look, let's leave behind the really rare, white rhino of autoimmune disease, and let's take a look at some of the more important in terms of volumes of people affected, like type 1 diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, you have reduced T-reg numbers and reduced function. And you have particular HLA tissue markers that are associated with this. So some people are going to, just because of their tissue compatibility, like when we do matching of organ transplants, those flags, well, people who have a certain flag get an even worse response. And lupus. Let's talk about lupus. What we see there is that there's a normal number of Treg cells, but they just don't work well. And the FOX, you see differences in how FOXP3 is working, methylation abnormalities. You see antibodies against Treg-associated molecules, and for some reason, the Treg cells don't migrate to the sites of inflammation the way they should. It's like the fireman staying in the firehouse because the pizza's so good letting the building burn down. Now, I know firemen never do that. It's a metaphor, guys. Please, don't call. Rheumatoid arthritis. There you see differences in the metabolic profiles of the T-cell function, and you see that the effector cells, that's the cells that are fighting disease, are resistant to Treg suppression. And so this is really a very polyfunctional core pivotal thing. And as we've studied it now, we've learned that it's tissue specific. So for example, in adipose or fat tissue, Tregs are specialized for metabolic control and tissue repair, and they cause or control insulin resistance. They regulate obesity. In intestines, Tregs are critical for maintaining tolerance to your probiotics. And this tolerance, these Tregs are induced to do that by metabolites that the microbiota produce. So the bacteria produce a signal to the Tregs telling them, hey, I'm a friend, don't attack me. And if this is messed up, this particular type of Treg cell, you're going to get Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. It's just going to evolve out of the absence of the Tregs in the gut. In the skin, they're very important for wound healing and maintaining the normal skin barrier and controlling skin turnover. And in the muscles, they express something called Areg, which is amphergulin, and somebody out there is working on this as a drug, I can tell you, because it is for tissue regeneration. So it turns those fibroblasts and those muscle cells that have been stressed, causes them to divide, and it is the secret. If we can figure out a drug and drug this system of the Tregs and the muscle, we can regulate age-related muscle decline. Now, we're not there yet, but the potential for this particular research is so huge that they won the Nobel Prize. There are a lot of drugs in development, including one that will be able to stop type 1 diabetes, lupus, and organ rejection. Another one, which is in phase 2 trials for atopic dermatitis and alopecia areata. That's the autoimmune disease where your hair falls out. There's one being in development for specifically liver transplant, another for kidney transplant, and most exciting at all, a autologous Treg therapy. So, in other words, taking your own blood, converting them into converting the T cells that you find into T regulatory cells, and then infusing it back in. A first in-human trial for chronic progressive multiple sclerosis, and it targets the myelin-specific immune response and stops it. Treg can be the enemy in cancer, so because it's regulating the immune system and you want the immune system to be actively fighting the cancer. In fact, one of the ways that cancers manage to infiltrate and evade the immune system is by interfering with the function of the Tregs. So this dynamic balance, I very ironically, is being thrown off. It is the cancer cells seem to know that genetically they have a way to go after the thing that's attacking them. Obviously, it's not an intelligence, but it's an amazing kind of probabilistic response. Still, crazy wild stuff. And so congratulations and you know, well warned. We're talking 30 years of work here, but it paid off for Mary Brunkow, Fred Ramsdell, and Shimon Sakaguchi. Let's go to an email. And this is from Elizabeth. Elizabeth says, random JAMA article. I'm generally not a huge fan of cohort association studies, especially small ones, but thought this one seemed interesting and would love your take on it. I don't know much about Egerthella. Seems to suggest a female-specific interaction between soft drink use, microbiome changes, and depression, study done in Germany. And yes, Elizabeth, I agree with you. Cohort association studies are low on the list of credibility because of the difficulty with all sorts of different variables. I was just reading one today about, you know, is dark chocolate and the flavonoids in it actually all that good for you, given the fact that the fat and the sugar come along for the ride? And somebody did a study where this is a good scientific study. They figured out how many flavonoids were in the usual half bar of dark chocolate, and then they gave people a capsule that had that many flavonoids in them, but they weren't from chocolate. And they basically got the same benefits that you see with the chocolate. So it's not just the chocolate, it's the plant compounds that are in the cacao. Is that meaningful? I mean, I love the fact that chocolate is marginally healthy for me, but that doesn't mean I'm going to consume bar after bar for other reasons, because I know that's ridiculous. To examine the association between soft drink consumption and depression diagnosis and severity, and whether this association is mediated by changes in the gut microbiota, particularly Egerthella and Hungrytella. So basically, they looked at a bunch of people in a cohort cross-sectional study that's been done in Germany. So they looked at healthy controls aged 18 to 65, and then they looked for the MDD diagnosis, that is to say, depression. And they looked at their diet and their soft drink consumption. And they controlled for location and education. And that's fine, but there's an awful lot of variables there that aren't being addressed. And they looked for two of the primary bacteria that have been found before in previous studies to be associated with depression. And what they found was that if you drank more soft drinks, you had more of the Egerthella. The problem here is correlation is not causality. So you had a little bit more Egerthella, but not more Hungrytella. Okay, great. But you don't know which way the arc of causality is going. We know that bacteria can influence what we eat and give us cravings. Is the act of drinking soda changing the Egerthella levels, or are the Egerthella levels changing the soft drink. And the association on this was statistically significant, but very small, about what we would call a risk ratio or an odds ratio of about 1.1, which means that maybe a 10% increase in association between drinking soft drinks and depression, which could very easily be affected by a third variable affected by a whole lot of other things. So I just don't think we can really hang our hat on this one. And again and again and again, correlation does not equal causality. Do the sodas cause the agritella? Does the agritella cause the sellers? And what about the undepressed population, and what happens if they're drinking sodas? You'd have to prove Koch's postulate, which is where you have to isolate the bacteria from the infection. Then you have to grow the bacteria and give it back to people who don't have the infection, and then they get sick with the disease. Then you can kind of say, all right, this causes the disease. This is a beautiful, sensitive, and wise essay that one of my friends sent to me. But as I read it, I thought to myself, in some ways, this could only have ever been written by a man. And if you are a woman listening to me, just keep listening and you will get it. Injury is the invitation to live from the inside out. Injury is how we are shocked into discovery. Injury is in some form the fate of every human being, and is always accompanied by a strange sense of its deeply fateful nature, as if this particular form of incapacitation had been waiting for us all along, as if this injury now belongs to me personally, as a birthright, as much as the knee it affects or the leg it has been broken. Despite the medical profession's general statistics around our accident or illness, injuries always feel deeply personal and somehow rebound on our identity and our life. Injury always makes us think in metaphors and even in mythic terms. Every injured person, given time and space, always trials multiple possibilities about what they did wrong or what they must learn from this seemingly fateful blow. Injury, we suspect, is the beckoning hand to an understanding we can only respond to after we have decided to turn down every other way of learning. The first shock of injury is how much pain the body or the mind seems to make us feel at the moment of injury. The pain can be literally unbelievable and untranslatable to another. The body, we are surprised to find, wants to let us know in no uncertain terms all the agonizing way that some holy parameter has been breached, that some wholeness is now less than whole, that some system is in disorder, no matter our wish to call it back to instant health and order. The underlying sense is that pain and disorder will endure until some wholeness is restored. Injury invites us to explore the opposite of perfection. Injury tells us we are about to begin our travels through the unending land of not quite right. The second shock is in coming to terms with the ever-present nature of our vulnerability, a vulnerability that the injury has suddenly and unaccountably uncovered. Until we were injured, we realized, we always floated 3 feet above the ground of actual reality, and often 3 feet above the realities of our own bodies. Injury refuses to let us take anything about our bodies or the world we have to negotiate for granted. Until we were injured, we never understood the miraculous nature of the heart with its never-ending fateful beat until the day it refuses to keep rhythm. We never knew the incredible abilities of the knee to keep us lithe and upright until we sustained that slight tear in our medial meniscus. We had absolutely no idea that our bone marrow was and is the birthplace of our very lifeblood until the word leukemia spilled from the doctor's lips like a low, far-off verbal thunderstroke, breaking over our unsuspecting lives. The third shock is that we have a completely different identity injured than we did when well. I am now a person who limps and is seen to limp, or who has lost an eye or a limb. I am a person whose hand trembles. I am a person who needs things I didn't need before, a crutch, a medicine, a watchful eye. Most tellingly and most humiliatingly, I am a person who obviously needs help before anyone even thinks about how I can help them. The fourth shock is how long the body takes and how much it needs to heal. patience is the sudden, necessary companion to injury. And equally suddenly, injury asks me to have a different relationship with time and the possibilities of time and what might potentially happen in a given span of time. Time may heal all, but I do not understand how much time that healing may take or how my understanding of the healing may change as time goes by. Injury humbles me in my understanding. How much time is now a question I know I can never, ever fully answer. The fifth shock of injury is understanding how much we have to turn our identities inside out in order to truly bring about the healing we desire. Injured, I have the opportunity to realize I have always treated the signals of the body as a nuisance, and that healing involves me understanding how much my mindset is the real nuisance in my body's attempt to heal. Injury is an invitation into the very touch point of the mind, the body, or the soul that was injured. The sixth shock is the way that the injury invites me to contemplate my past and the way I've neglected my body in the past. Until I get to the center of my emotional wound, I do not realize how much my childhood trauma asked for in the way of constant emotional protection. Until I stationed myself in the very center of the pain of my trembling knee, I did not really understand how many decades my knee has supported me without question, and how little support I have offered in return. Until I'm injured, I did not realize how much I have been asking my body for nonstop performance, rarely giving it the rest or care it needs. The road to healing is the road that reshapes my previous relationship with the body. To take care of my knee, I need to put my consciousness at the very center of that astonishing complex of bone, muscle, cartilage, and fascia, and have it speak back to the rest of me, telling me what it needs and doesn't want from moment to moment. I walk at my knee's direction instead of trying to make my knee correspond to some golden abstract idea of how I think it should perform. Our first reaction to injury is to tell the injury to get better and as soon as possible, but we each of us know exactly how we react to being given imperatives about bucking up, getting over it, and getting well. To begin to heal is always to step back and let the injury tell us what it needs and lead us where it wants to go. Until we were injured, we did not understand how fine the line was between health and incapacitation, between being robustly independent and being vulnerable to other people's necessary help, and astonishingly at times, being absolutely helpless without that help. Until we were injured, we were under the delusion that we were secure from humiliation, and that in the spirit of that word, we didn't need a well-developed sense of humor. Until we were injured, we didn't really accept that we were just as amusingly and not so amusingly vulnerable as everyone else. Injury fully felt and fully accepted grants us compassion. Injured, we now know how easily mere mortals are overwhelmed by circumstance, how the greatest of reputations can dissolve with infirmity, and how everyone else in our world deserves a measure of understanding just for the act of having been born into the illusory robustness of their all-too-vulnerable, fragile, accident-prone bodies. Injury is our unconscious enrollment in a fully earned form of hard-won presence, a doorway of compassion for others, and a threshold of maturation. We cross that threshold of maturation that injury provides only with our slight limp or our bad back. We enter only by holding our side when we feel the pain. We learn compassion only by helping the part of us that cannot help itself. And out of that, we learn to help others who cannot help themselves. Through injury, we reach an earned state of understanding that we realize can often only be reached by those who crawl across that difficult, hard-won line of maturity, determinedly, metaphorically or actually, on their trembling hands and knees. My comment on this really wonderful essay is, God bless the men who get midlife without ever realizing that they are victims of circumstance and that they do not control their bodies. That is why I believe that, among other things, menstruation kind of disabuses you of any sense of complete control over your body fairly early on. The second thing I will say about it is, as a physician, I have observed so many times the ego crisis that happens to a person when they go from being healthy to being a person with the disease, what I call a PWD. And it's a real wrench to re-identify yourself as having a disease, whether that disease is potentially lethal, like a cancer diagnosis, or whether it's disabling, or whether it's a mental DSM-5 type illness. We conceptualize ourselves as invulnerable, and that's when we're healthy. When we become a person with disease, it requires a whole restructuring of our self-definition, and for some people, this can be extremely difficult. I work hard to be sensitive and to train my students to be sensitive to this because I think it's so critical to support people as they come across that transition of how they consider of conceive of themselves. And it's a very important maturing experience, and it's also a real challenge and can definitely shake the foundations. So if this happens to someone you love or someone you know, be ready to let them talk to you. Be ready to also help them see that they are no less of a person because they have lost a capacity or because they've sustained a loss, that they can, in fact, be stronger and more of a person. Well, we have a caller on the line, and please tell me your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Ian, and I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Well, hello, Ian, and what can I do for you tonight?
Well, I wanted to call and respond to that essay. I found it very inspiring, and I found it confirming a conviction of mine concerning our idea of health and disease. So I just wanted to comment about it. May I do that?
Of course.
Yes. Again, thank you for bringing that to our attention. I think it's very valuable. And the reason I think it's very valuable, because it inverts our attitude about health and disease. And I think we've had a very negative attitude toward disease. And I think there is a not only a physical component to that, but also a psychological component, and even, I would say, a metaphysical component that is kind of almost mythic in its scope. And to demonstrate what I am talking about, may I read you three quotes that would take less than a minute to read?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, the first is from an artist of the French writer, the French writer André Gide, who said, "Illness opens doors to a reality that remains closed to the healthy point of view." Again, I think we've had too much of this healthy-mindedness. And so I want to quote two more. The second is from a Jungian psychologist, in fact, and what is called archetypal psychology. And Dr. James Hillman writes, "The soul sees by means of affliction. Illness opens doors to reality which remains closed to the healthy point of view. The soul's native insight is its native pathology." And finally, from Professor Norman O. Brown of UCSC, who said, because I'm reading this because in the essay he mentioned the word vulnerable, which is cognate to the word wound. So let me read it. "To be is to be vulnerable, wounded. The defense mechanisms, the character armor, is to protect from life. Frailty alone is human. A broken, ground-up heart, a contrite heart. Open is broken. There is no breakthrough without breakage."
I really like that last one. And mm-hmm. The idea that the natural state of the soul is wounded is, I mean, if I'm paraphrasing it, of course, but I think that many of the world's religions have an element of embracing the wound, so either your own or someone else's, as a path to spiritual enlightenment. I've never really thought about it. I've all kind of smirked at it, quite honestly. But in this conversation, I think I'm going to have to spend some more time thinking about that and what it really says about the human condition and about the nature of life, the universe, and everything.
Right. And again, you know, the idea of brokenheartedness has a very positive element, whether in love or existential situations. And in fact, when you said every religion, even Christianity, I think there's a quote in the Bible that goes something like, the Lord loves those or is close to those who are brokenhearted.
And I think the other thing that we all suffer, if we aren't suffering now, we will at some point suffer. And that point that he makes in the article, and by the way, I should say that the author of that is David White, W-H-Y-T-E. And I will go ahead and post a link to this article in the resources section on the website. So if anyone wants to read it or share it, they'll be able to do so.
Oh, that's great. And I am familiar with David White, and I can tell you the poet David White is a big fan of James Hillman. So it is that's a great connection. So because it sounded so much like a lot of Hillman's writings.
Well, I think it's probably true. And of course, we all experience it differently. Speaking from the perspective of a physician, we see so much death and suffering early in our lives. And I've always been really grateful that I dissected a body that was younger than me in my mid-20s. And so it just blew any conception. I mean, it wasn't an old person. Most of the bodies were old, but it's like, any idea that you were somehow, because you were young, invulnerable, got, you know, just left on the cutting room floor, so to speak. And that has informed the decisions and the life I've lived in, you know, fundamental ways, I would say. So,
Wow.
And doctors have all sorts of adaptive responses to this, and the fear of your own mortality and being reminded of it, and the sympathy and empathy and how painful that can be, and learning to be in the room with that pain and be okay with it and accept it as part of the human experience. That's a big gift that I got there, and I'm very grateful for it.
Yes, and about that pain, it has been said as a criticism of our ideas about health. You know, people go to a doctor, they want to just give me a pill, I want to get rid of the pain, whether that works for them or not. It's the attitude that, you know, anything but to stay with the pain, whether that pain is physical or psychological. Don't stay with the pain. Maybe instead see where the pain is taking you. And as a matter of fact, this is another problem with our attitude about healthy mindedness, which, by the way, the great psychologist and philosopher William James, long ago talking about religion in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, had a whole chapter criticizing what he called healthy mindedness,
which was very big in his era.
Sort
of, it's kind of tied with the general American boosterism of its era. But it begins the myth that, you know, men are the myth of the frontiersman, you know, who's doesn't need anybody's help and who's, bulletproof. And then we have all those cowboy movies. It gets into everybody's head as the model of masculinity. But, you know, my model for masculinity is the person who, is ready and able to help, but the person who experiences their own pain and disappointment and, you know, acknowledges it and doesn't just, you know, push on through without examining it, because I think that ideal, and you know, it's partly born of sports, and, you know, well, you've got to keep running on that injured knee because the team needs you, and then, of course, you're crippled for the rest of your life. It's very toxic, and the sooner you get over that, the better, I think.
Right.
Maybe we should all have something painful happen to us in our early 20s. That's pretty extreme stance. Well, thank you very much for the call and the little digression into intellectual conversation. It's been lovely. Any last words?
Just keep on doing what you're doing, Dr. Dawn. I think the Case Quiz is just blessed to have you.
I'll be sure I mention that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have another email, but I wanted to read this after that essay because it's about pain behavior. So let me tell you the story of Joe Lawrence, a firefighter in Western Australia, who was pulling a hose over a fence when he felt a sudden sharp pain shoot down his back. He was then 27, and he describes the pain as pretty horrific. I spent a week in bed not being able to move. After the injury, his back hurt every minute of the day. He tried Pilates and worked with a physical therapist and a chiropractor. And eventually, he went to see a physician. And the doctor told Lawrence he had the spine of a person twice his age. This is the moment of truth here, because that doctor hypnotized the patient without meaning to. Lawrence gave up all his outdoor hobbies and started looking for a new career because he believed his back would never recover. Lawrence has been working with Peter O'Sullivan, a professor of musculoskeletal physiotherapy at Curtin University in Perth, Australia. O'Sullivan and his colleagues have created a personalized physical therapy program that they call cognitive functional therapy. This has been around for about 12 years now. It's an individual approach to managing chronic pain in which a physical therapist coaches a person through the physical and psychological challenges of their pain and disability. Lawrence said that in just one session with O'Sullivan, he did things he hadn't done since his back pain began. O'Sullivan says, "We teach them ways to move to get back to doing the stuff they love in a normal, relaxed way." They're in the process of doing a large study. They've recruited 500 people, and this is not something you can do in a double-blind function. But Lawrence is back to doing things that he never thought he would be able to do. "I run, I cycle, I surf, and I don't even think about my back." How does this work? Well, obviously, non-steroidal and spinal manipulation with chiropractic typically are short-term things. The cognitive function aims to address the psychological aspects of persistent low back pain. People often believe that back pain means the spine is damaged, fragile, and needs to be protected. So they tense their muscles. They stiffen them to guard against any movement that might exacerbate the pain. Sullivan says that's a little bit like walking around with a clenched fist when you've got a sore wrist. Clenching the fist only makes things work. Backs are designed for movement. The goal is to help someone work through their anxiety or fear of the pain so that they can return to bending and twisting as they normally would, perhaps a bit more carefully or a bit more consciously. But the first thing to do, Lawrence said, was all of those beliefs I had that I needed to protect my back, that my back was fragile, that I can't bend, I can't twist. O'Sullivan just challenged those things and tried to undo them. Sitting, standing, or bending in a certain way might be painful, but O'Sullivan says there is no perfect posture. In fact, contracting your back muscles to sit bolt upright could lead to more back pain. So cognitive functional therapy is three broad steps. First of all, make sense of what contributes to a person's pain and how it affects their daily life. You might want to get an MRI, rule out tumors, fractures, infections. But if it's chronic low back pain and there's no sign of any disease process, they delve down a little bit more, get the whole picture. How did it start? An acupuncture analysis, what was going on emotionally at the time that the pain began or at the time of the injury is key. And also, have you had that pain before? I find is a very good question to ask. And then how do you respond to the pain when you get it? And then gradually, you work with the person to practice the activities and exercises and movements that they're tending to avoid. You get them moving one by one, learning to relax your body, and just go with it, go with the flow, and go slowly. Let your body get reaccustomed to movement. And the lack of movement has become a large contributor to the actual pain that they're experiencing. Also, healthy routines like consistent sleep and regular exercise. Pain is complex. It's not just a sensation. It's a signal that gets all kinds of cognitive, emotional, and overlay and motivational overlay in the brain. That essay that we just talked about people redefining themselves as a person who can't versus a person who can, is key to working with patients with chronic pain. Okay, so the price war is on weight loss drugs, and Ozempic and Wegovy are now available for $4.99 a month at Costco. And Lilly and Novo Nordisk have set up online stores where you can buy their drugs. Part of what made them drop their price, I will add, is all of the compounding pharmacies that have made cheap imitations using the powder of the drugs and then turning them into injectables. And people are crazy for this stuff. The price of healthcare, 13% of the healthcare budget, the global healthcare budget in 2024 went to pay for these drugs. And the list price is ridiculous. It's like $13,000 for Wegovy. In 2023, we spent $71 billion. We can't stop the drug companies from charging what they think they can charge. But it's been really, really interesting to see how the imitators, the compounders, have kind of come in, moved in on the market. And there's been, you know, literally the price has been cut by more than 50% right there. Now you've got similar discounts at CVS and Walmart. Everything is just going to this new price point, and the dynamics of it are pretty fascinating. While we're talking about pharmacies, I want to put in a shot, pardon the pun, for immunizations. It's definitely past due for flu shot by Halloween. Okay, always. I feel like from my clinical experience and also from looking at the vaccines, you can definitely do flu and RSV at the same visit, one in each arm, and I'm not seeing any problems from that or reports of problems from that. I do advise the shingles shot. Then there's an interesting study. One of the reasons I'm talking about this is that recent studies have been showing that people who get vaccinated have lower risks of dementia. Well, is it just because those are people who are more health conscious, so they're getting the vaccine? But there was a study done, finished in 2025, and it relates to when the Public Health Service in England began offering the shot, and they offered you had to be a certain age to get the shingles vaccine. And what they saw was that it rolls out in one part of the country, and then a couple of years later it rolls out in another part of the country. And what they were able to see was that the shingles shot reduced dementia risk by about 20% over a 7-year period. And that's a substantial number. There's lots of studies that are backing this up. What's at the root of it? Well, the root of dementia, and particularly Alzheimer's disease, is uncontrolled inflammation in the brain that is causing damage, like a smoldering fire between the walls of your house. It's burning things down that can't be rebuilt. And the zoster virus is, that causes shingles, is a neurotrophic virus. And it can live in the, it can hibernate in the nervous system. It hibernates in your spinal cord. So it can more directly affect the brain. And while we're talking vaccinations, getting a chickenpox vaccine can prevent you from ever having shingles. If you get a chickenpox vaccine in childhood, you will never get chickenpox and you will never get shingles. So why we need to sell that on the get the chicken, give the chickenpox to your kids and they will not have to worry about ever getting shingles. As I said, the Wales and Australia set different vaccine eligibility dates, and it gave us a natural experiment that showed that this is a pretty strong effect. Now, could this be, could these vaccines, and the same thing is shown actually for even a tetanus shot, seems to be lowering the risk of dementia. Why and how could that be? Well, after talking earlier in this program about the Nobel Prize, I'm wondering if the vaccinations could actually lead to the development of T regulatory cells in the target tissues of the vaccine. It's hypothetical, but something happens after the vaccine that activates the immune system in a way that reduces inflammation. And I'm sorry, but T regulatory cells, now that we understand them and what they do, seem like a really good candidate to explain the connection. All right, we're going to wrap up with one quick and simple health tip. Lose the plastic cups and lose the plastic containers and take things out of plastic before you cook them. Use a ceramic cup for your coffee. You know, get a metal or a glass tea kettle for boiling water. Don't use a plastic tea kettle. Don't wash your polyester clothing on high heat. Heat causes microplastics. It's as simple as that. If you reduce the amount of heat that a container that contains plastic is subject to, and you don't reuse containers because they deteriorate over time. They did one study looking at 8-year-old coffee machines with plastic components, and they had twice as many microplastic as a similar machine that was only 6 months old. So after reading this, I'm like, oh, there's plastic in my coffee maker. I need my coffee. I'm going to have to figure out a different strategy. It probably won't be nearly as convenient, but you know, it's cautionary principle. We do not know how much damage these things do. And the evidence that we see so far ain't good. You should avoid it. Keep the plastic away from heat. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.